welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here on this little podcast, as we are here every week or so, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, we have my good friend, Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, Southern gentleman, raconteur, favorite Dutch uncle, author of all kinds of books, The Apostasy That Wasn't, and Four Witnesses, and The Christus Experiment, and Chesterton's America, and, well, just ever so much productivity and mellifluousness flowing from his pen. Welcome, Rod Bennett. How you doing?
I'm very glad to be back.
Good, good. Colin, speaking from the Smoky Mountains out there in East Tennessee.
Yeah, a pretty day today, although a little hot.
Waiting for the eclipse to happen. We are 1 month away from the grand solar eclipse.
Yeah, and my house drew the lucky hand this time, because the path of totality goes directly over the top of my house this time.
That is super cool. I burn with envy. That's just really neat.
It's a lot of fun.
I'm going to try to get a buddy and drive down to Oregon, which apparently they're saying Oregon is just going to be a huge mess. So now I'm trying to think about maybe if we go over the mountains and go to eastern Oregon where there isn't anybody.
Yeah, would be my bet
too. Yeah, because if I go down I-5, I have this feeling that I-5 is going to be the world's biggest traffic jam of people like me, who my big plan was to drive down there and just pull over on the side of the freeway and just watch.
Seattle and San Francisco are probably going to both converge on that same stretch of the freeway. So
yeah, that's what I'm thinking, is everybody in the West Coast is just going to drive up I-5 and see if they can see it, and that's going to be a lot of no fun. So if you go to Eastern Washington or Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington are the same eco zone, which is sort of semi-arid desert.
Right.
I don't mean like, you know, sand dunes desert, but there's a lot of nothing out there. And the only reason Eastern Washington is the huge fertile fruit basket that it is now is because FDR built the Bonneville Power Administration, and there's 50 dams along the Columbia, and so they've been able to irrigate the whole of eastern of the Columbia River Valley. So that's turned the place into a huge fruit basket, because the place is this astonishing region of geological catastrophes that if they were happening today, these things would dominate the headlines. I mean, they would be world historical catastrophes, but they all happened before there was any history. So
we had a little taste of this a few years back with Mount St. Helens, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, a very tiny taste. The main thing that shaped Eastern, well, there are two things that shaped Eastern Washington. One was that the hot spot that is now under Yellowstone 11 million years ago was under Idaho, and it disgorged huge rivers of liquid molten basalt that built up Eastern Washington. That's why there's such a thing as a Grand Coulee, is because there were layer after layer of basalt that built up hundreds of feet high, including one layer of basalt that overran an unfortunate rhinoceros and then wore away. And now there's a cave shaped like a rhinoceros. Up in the cliff above Blue Lake. So that's pretty cool. But then about 11,000 years ago, as the glacier was pulling away from the what are now the Clark it's Clark River, I think. What happened was this glacier took a long time to go away. And so it blocked up the Clark River. And as the Clark River backed up, it backed up to form a lake that basically covered the state of Montana. So we're talking about a lake that's the size of Lake Michigan, called Lake Missoula, which they didn't know existed until they started doing aerial surveillances, and they saw, look, giant bathtub rings over the state of Montana. That used to be a primeval lake. Well, the amazing thing is, imagine some catastrophe happening in which a volume of water the size of Lake Michigan just suddenly disgorged itself into Illinois.
Be
And
hard
had
on
to,
the occupants.
yeah, it'd be hard on the occupants, and it has to go somewhere, so it hits the Mississippi River, and then all that wall of water comes roaring down the Mississippi and destroys everything till it gets to Louisiana. Well, that's what happened, and happened like 100 times now, they estimate, in eastern Washington on a, on a regular basis, is the ice blockage from the glacier would break, and then suddenly Lake Missoula would just disgorge itself into what is now the Columbia River Valley, and then run down the Columbia River in a wall of water. If you ever get a chance to come to Washington and see the Columbia River, what you'll see now is this lovely, it's a big river, but in comparison to the water that came through the coulees, it's a pleasant trickling brook. And the coulees tower, the walls of the coulee tower over the Columbia River, hundreds of feet high. Well, when that thing was at full flood, the coulee was full up to the tip top. That's what made the coulees, was the water blasting through there just tore away at the tore away at the basalt and washed the whole thing downstream. And then it came down, it made a sharp right going west and filled up the Willamette River Valley. So Portland, where Portland now stands, the tallest buildings in Portland would have been the only thing sticking out of the water. And it so it, it disgorged itself in the Willamette Valley, and then
Sorry about that, Mark. That was the call I was anticipating.
okay,
I'm
all right,
sorry.
no problem.
Keep going with the
This
geology lesson.
is raw podcasting as it happens in life, man. This is there's no artifice here. We
A
are.
very a very let me see. Hold on.
Hello.
You're listening
It's
to the
Sam doing the podcast with Mark Shea. Can I call you back later? Okay.
incarnation
Okay.
of
All right.
real life
All right. See ya.
Okay. Sorry. That was a really important call that I was hoping to put off, but there we go.
It's like,
All right. All right. Hopefully we'll edit that out. I
now we're capturing the grit and dirt of
I guess.
life as it's really lived. So anyway, yeah, so if Portland were there 11,000 years ago, that whole the
It
only the
soon
tallest
wouldn't
buildings,
be there.
yeah, it would not be there. And yeah, and then all that water, barfed itself out of the Columbia River at the mouth of the Columbia. And if some guy back in the 20s started wandering around eastern Washington going, this really looks like it was made by giant floods. Everything around here looks like it's the result of a huge flood. Well, the geological community in the 20s was like, no, there's no such thing as catastrophism. It doesn't happen. And this sounds too much like Noah's flood, so no.
Yes.
And so they were really hostile to the guy. He couldn't get anybody to listen to him, but he just kept pointing to the evidence that does in fact show very clearly that there were enormous floods in eastern Washington. There's actually a place called Dry Falls that you could see that it was obviously a huge waterfall, and there's like big craters at the bottom of where the fall was, that where the spill hit the ground and dug it out and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd point to stuff like that, and there are these giant rock bombs that are just kind of scattered all over eastern Washington that he said, you know, these are very clearly rocks that were washed here. And all these other things, right? And what made these coulees and so on. And nobody listened to him for a good long while, but he kept piling up the evidence. And finally they said, well, if there was a flood, then where did the water come from? And he said, beats me. But obviously there was a flood here. And they didn't figure it out until they started doing aerial surveys of Montana. And then there was a plausible explanation for where all these floodwaters came from. And they went, you know what? It looks like Eastern Washington was created by colossal floods. He's going, yeah, I know.
isn't it interesting how so many of these really mind-blowing things, you know, eruption of that Yellowstone caldera and all the rest of it,
yeah,
happened a long time ago. In other words, the world certainly seems to have been a more violent, I mean, prehistoric monsters crawling around on it and all of that sort of thing. It makes you happy to live now, but
yes.
Probably this is a matter of scale. Probably there were lots of periods in between all this disaster where things were happy like they are here.
Right. Well, and that's it. You know, it part of it is just our human perspective on time makes hard for us to. I'm sure a dinosaur, you know, an intelligent dinosaur living about 65 million years ago, you know, if you were able to dig up evidence of the Permian extinction, which is, by the way, the biggest extinction in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think it's like 80% of all life on Earth was killed in the Permian extinction. I'm sure a dinosaur looking at that 65 million years ago would be saying, isn't it great that we live in such a peaceful time?
right. I scared some of my friends a while back. Do you remember the year when we had five hurricanes, strong hurricanes, made landfall in Florida?
Uh-huh.
During one season.
Okay.
And everybody said, oh, this is so freaky and strange. So, you know, and, you know, I just sort of idly in one conversation said, you know, we haven't been keeping record of weather long enough to know what normal is here.
Mm.
You know, maybe we're on the 500-year cycle.
Yeah.
Maybe Florida is completely uninhabitable and we just haven't realized it yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm waiting for, you know, the New Yorker magazine, I think, did a story a couple of years ago on the Cascadia Fault, which is out off the coast from my house.
Well, we had a little tsunami scare the other night, didn't
yes,
we?
Yes, they One, did up yeah. in the Aleutians. Yeah, nothing came of it, thanks be to God. But, the Cascadia Fault is responsible for destroying a generation of Japanese. On the east coast the east coast of Japan, because in 1700 there was a massive quake. The quake in Anchorage in 1964 was a 9.2.
Yeah, now that's the one where you see video of the waves, sea waves on a concrete highway.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible piece of film.
So, and the Cascadia Fault is, it's going to be something like that. So they're basically saying, you know, if you're on the Pacific coast, somewhere between Northern California and Vancouver, and that thing goes off, you know, just drop everything and run for your life. Cause you're going to die. And, but yeah, so
now Japan does seem to be a place that gets the crap kicked out of it on a more human scale.
It does. Well, the thing of it in 1700 was there, I mean, they're used to earthquakes because they live on a fault. But the weird thing about the tsunami in 1700 was that there was no earthquake. It just came out of nowhere and obliterated the whole east coast of Japan. Well, now they know where it came from. It came from about 30 miles off of, you know, my house.
Yeah.
And so there, and it had devastating effects here in Washington, but Washington was inhabited by Native Americans who mostly lived far enough inland. You know, they're Pacific Coast Indians, and I'm not sure what became of them. If they were anywhere near the beach, then they all died.
Yeah, there was within our lifetimes. I mean, back in the, I'm not sure the exact date, the 60s or 70s, I believe, a hurricane hit Bangladesh, I think.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Drowned 500,000 people or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Monstrous, huge hurricane. Yeah. There was, I remember the concert for Bangladesh. Thank you, George.
Scary place. Actually, I think the concert was, it may have been before the hurricane, because the concert was political unrest was the cause of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was for the, I thought it was because of the monsoon.
Yeah, that's, I think I used to think that too, but I read an article about it, and apparently it was refugees from a war crisis.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Well, hey, I've got you on the show today because, you've been thinking a lot about, Marcion, and I thought it would be worth bringing up, Marcion. He's, most people aren't too familiar with Marcion today, but Marcion is a heretic from the second century who pioneers complaints and gripes and ideas that are going to continue to echo down through history. Some of them, you know, embraced by Christians in various ways too, and some of them embraced by critics of Christianity, some of them embraced by atheists. And so I thought it would be interesting to spend a little time and talk about Marcion today.
Yeah, that's right. It's an interesting topic.
So tell me about Marcion.
Well, the only reason I know anything about this subject is that I got picked to write a book about law issues, about how exactly the how exactly it is that the Old Testament laws were fulfilled and in what sense they were fulfilled.
Okay.
And the various fallouts that happened in church history over people trying to understand how this law given by Moses, which, by the way, is referred to in the Old Testament as perpetual or everlasting nearly 100 times.
Right.
An unbreakable perpetual covenant.
Right.
How it is that this could pass away, how it is that Christians can believe, in its simplest form, it's a question about how it is that Christians can believe and hold the Old Testament to be the Word of God without keeping all of the many laws that are in it.
Right.
And so that this pretty this these are the sorts of questions that gave rise to several different heresies, theological dead ends.
Right.
In those early days, especially before the break between the synagogue and the church became permanent,
mm-hmm.
or you know, an actual breach between the two ways of looking at things sealed itself, I suppose.
Right.
And one of these two heresies was that of Marcion.
Okay.
And so that's the only reason I know anything about this. So this is a disclaimer so that if the listeners will not say, well, gee, that Rod is a know-it-all. Mark can just mention a name and he knows everything about it. I have an excuse. I have an excuse. I really do.
Okay, that's good.
But yes, you know, one of the things, though, that ought to be said, you're exactly right. Marcionism is a thing that crops up in the church pretty frequently,
mm-hmm.
In one form or another.
Right.
You'll often hear...
crops up people, outside the church, too.
Well, yeah, you'd never get too far outside the church in the United States.
Well,
even the atheists are fundamentalists in the United States.
Especially the atheists. Well, I was just reading something today from some guy, you know, I'm an ex-Catholic. When I was 13 years old, I read the Old Testament, and I rejected that barbaric God.
Right, right, right.
And that's that. You're a Marcionite, pal, you know.
We should go ahead and spell out what Marcion did.
Yeah.
He essentially is a guy who I think he started out as a Judaizer. And that's counterintuitive, I know.
Okay.
One of the Judaizers were people who absolutely, and Christians, who absolutely insisted that the Christians did still have to keep the law of Moses.
Okay.
And they tried in various ways to work that out in the face of apostolic opposition and opposition by the successors of the apostles. So, you know,
he was the son of a bishop, right?
Marcion? Yes, he was. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. He was. And appears to have been a bishop himself. He may have been made. I mean, when we think of a son of a bishop these days, we probably got him around these days, but they're a bit more of a scandal than they would have been then.
That's when it was still fine for bishops to run.
That's
around.
When it was still okay for a married man to become a bishop. Yes. There's never been a time, this is a total footnote, but there's never been a time, as far as we know, when a bishop could marry. But there was a time when a married man could become a bishop.
Right.
That's a fine distinction, but important. But that's a rabbit trail, so we'll avoid that.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Marcion's father was the bishop of the church at Sinope, which is a seaport town on the Black Sea in what was called Pontus at that time.
Okay.
And he appears to have groomed his son to be a kind of a junior suffragan bishop at the same church.
Someday, son, all this will be yours.
That's right. Yeah. They sort of groomed his own successor, which obviously seems, like a piece of unwise nepotism.
Well, and that's where we got celibate bishops from.
Yes. Yes.
There were a lot of bishops that thought, we'll just turn this into the family business.
Well, how unwise is perhaps indicated by the fact that he ended up having to excommunicate his own son eventually.
Oh, really? I didn't realize his own father had done that.
He threw him out of the church, and I think for Judaizing. And like I say, that seems a counterintuitive idea, because the Judaizers, again, insisted on absolute obedience to the old law of Moses.
Got to be circumcised, have to keep kosher, can't trim the edges of your beard, need to, you know,
follow all the rest
the whole,
of it, yeah.
The whole thing, yeah.
Yeah. And the reason I think that that's the case is that if you look very carefully, Marcion's system is a Judaizing system up until the very last moment. In other words,
I'm interested.
Yeah, he grants with the Hebrews that the law of Moses is perfect. It's a perfect reflection of the personality and character of its author, divine author, and that it is perpetual and unbreakable, and that it was given as an absolute requirement forever to the Hebrews. And that, in other words, he pretty much grants the entire contention of the Judaizing Christian, that it's an absolute necessity and that it can't pass away, that the idea that it could be in some way done away with was absurd. And that's the Judaizing position, but it's also Marcion's position. Marcion's twist comes right at the very end, like a sort of a Twilight Zone ending, where Marcion says, yes, but the God that gave it, the God of the Hebrews, was not the ultimate God. Yes, he was the creator of the world. Yes, he was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there was a greater God above him and over him.
Why his father excommunicated him.
Yes. Well, I think his father excommunicated him for Judaizing. Okay. I think these errors came later. I think they came in response to having been excommunicated.
Okay.
But that's something I go into more in the book. But basically, he was caught. The old proverb about being stuck between when an immovable object is met by an irresistible force.
Okay.
Essentially, that I think is the vice that that Marcion was caught in.
Okay.
We've called him a heretic, and he was, but the one thing that he set him apart or cut him off from the rest of the Judaizers was the fact that he had an absolute devotion to Jesus Christ. he wouldn't apostatize as most of the Judaizers eventually ended up doing.
Okay.
Well, the Judaizing system was in and of itself an apostasy, because almost all of them, even though some of them granted Jesus a virgin birth or some of the other things, almost all of them ended up demoting him to being a mere human prophet.
Okay.
And this is something Marcion would never do. He had a profound personal devotion to the divine Son of God and would not listen to any Judaizing attempt to demote him in some way as somebody who didn't fulfill all of Moses's law, but was a prophet who brought more law.
Okay.
But you can see how, if you're caught between those two things, between retaining the divine Son of God and retaining the Old Testament God, whose character seems a little spotty at times.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Marcion wrote a book called The Contrast, where he sets out a lot of contrast between the Old Testament and the New Testament God,
right?
As he would put it,
right?
The Hebrew God, was sort of a slave driver, a hard taskmaster, whereas Jesus came to set the captives free. You know,
right? Right.
Christ said, "Turn the other cheek," and Moses said, "An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth."
Right. Yeah.
And Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." And his ostensible father, on the other hand, once sent some bears to devour some kids for getting a little too sassy with one of his prophets.
Yeah.
So Marcion definitely had the idea that the Old Testament God was
bad,
bloodthirsty and barbaric.
Right.
Actually, it's interesting. You use that word bad. That actually is something Marcion avoided.
Oh, interesting.
His twist was to say he certainly wouldn't have been the first person to come up with the idea of a good God and a bad God. That's
right.
Just Persian Manichaeism.
Right.
His twist was to say that the Hebrew God is a just God, and the God revealed by Jesus is a merciful God.
Okay.
So that's a very interesting twist on the thing,
mm-hmm.
because it sets justice and mercy at odds with each other, as of course they must always be in one of the mysteries of our faith, is that the two things are at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. Mercy is not justice. Mm-hmm. That's why there's two different words for them. Mm-hmm. You know, but at any rate, the point here is, without going into another digression, is that Marcion actually began to teach that Jesus had come to reveal a whole nother God. And he seems to have picked up on the idea that when Paul, for example, went to Mars Hill and said he was going to reveal the unknown God.
Mm-hmm.
This was literally a God that nobody had known until Jesus appeared to reveal him.
Okay.
You see, and it's a contrast with the Hebrew God, whom everybody did know, and they knew he was a man of war, as his people championed him.
Okay. You know?
So this is where it gets really interesting, in my opinion, is most Marcionism you hear today is pop Marcionism.
Okay.
In other words, you will sometimes hear, even from a Catholic pulpit, the idea that the Old Testament God was a God of judgment and stern and unbending, and he wasn't really interested in a relationship, just obedience.
Right.
Whereas Jesus came to reveal for the first time the true nature of God, who's a God of love, you know.
Right.
And, there's just enough truth in this caricature to keep it from lapsing completely over into to heresy.
Right, right.
But the interesting thing is, this isn't what Marcion said, not in his maturity, not in the fullness of his system after he broke with the church.
Okay.
What most modern pop Marcionites mean when they say this is, what they're really saying is, the ancient Hebrews had barbaric ideas about God, and Jesus brought better ideas about God.
Okay.
Marcion doesn't say this at all. He says there actually is a god who is barbaric.
Okay.
Okay. And in other words, the modern Marcion idea is really a piece of biblical criticism, masquerading right. as theology.
Well, and anti-Semitism.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
But essentially, they're saying these prophets, you got to take what they said with a grain of salt.
Right.
In other words, they misrepresented God.
Okay.
Whereas Marcion was saying, no, they represented him perfectly accurately.
Okay. So, and, so there's this barbaric God that really exists, according to Marcion.
Right.
But then there's Jesus, the son of some other God that we've never heard of, but now
is that's revealed. Right. Exactly. He came to reveal the previously unknown God who is actually above the other God. So the God is a bit of a Gnostic demiurge, you know,
okay.
This idea was floating around in the drinking water in those days.
Okay, so in this system, then there are what, two gods?
There's two gods.
There's the barbaric God, and then there's the unknown God that Jesus just revealed.
Or in a said more correctly, there's a just God, and a just God and a sinful people are going to make a bad mix.
Okay.
Okay. You're definitely going to perceive God as bad if you're sinful, and he cares only about obedience.
Okay. So wow, this gets really complicated. So, but I mean, essentially, I mean, he really is arguing for polytheism.
Yes. Although, you know, in these early days, before a lot of the church, before the first church did a lot of very serious thinking about the Trinity and things of this type, there were a lot of people who, even Justin himself, Justin Martyr, who was the great Marcion's great opponent, even some of his ideas about the fatherhood and sonship of Christ, as expressed in his surviving writings, don't pass the test of Nicene Orthodoxy.
Right. Yeah. Well,
they were
still too early. This out. Yeah.
That's right. Too early.
Church is still trying to figure this out.
Right. There hadn't been a definitive statements on the subject yet, so they were still hashing everything over.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out how it is that the God revealed in the New Testament, which certainly seems on the face of it to be more than one God.
Yeah.
In other words, and many people will fall into dietheism.
Right.
Trying to explain the Trinity.
Right.
It's pretty common.
Right.
You'll either fall into Sabellianism, modalism, as it's sometimes called, where Father and Son are just and Spirit too are just three different aspects of the same God.
Right.
One God acting as if he were three.
Right. Yeah.
That's more common to run across these days.
I ran across that when I was a brand new evangelical. I had a friend of mine trying to explain the Trinity to me, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm an uncle and a brother and a son." And
our friend Lent Hatcher described this memorably as the God's three hats heresy.
Yes, exactly. The God's three hats heresy.
God is like the small town mayor of yore who, in addition to his tall hat that he keeps for his highest office, he also keeps a policeman's hat and a fire chief's helmet on hand.
Yeah.
Should the need arise.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, one of the things that I think is very interesting about the rise of the church, and you can see it most clearly in the contrast with Islam, is that because the church spent its first three centuries getting kicked around and killed mostly, and then quietly growing, what you get in the early church is this fascinating, the church is a literary movement, in a sense. You get people like Justin Martyr and others arguing with each other about ideas. And so the church doesn't say, okay, Christ is risen, let's take up swords and go conquer the world, because they can't do that. They're poor and weak and slaves, and they're mostly getting killed and martyred. And when they're not, they're arguing, like Justin Martyr is doing, they're arguing with the world. So Justin's writings consist of arguments with a Jewish guy and appeals to, you know, people who want to kill him.
The Roman emperors, yeah.
And the fathers of the church are going to spend a lot of time arguing with people like Marcion and saying, you know, you're wrong about these ideas. And, you know, as has famously been said of Muhammad, Muhammad was his own Constantine. And so Muhammad immediately, you know, sets out. He's got a very simple idea. And then he immediately sets out, and so do his successors, on campaigns of conquest. The early church can't do that. And it's not, it's, that's not what it's designed to do. And so consequently you get these very fine-tuned
right
disputes about things like this. You know, who is God? You know, how many, what do we mean when we say there's one God? You know, and if there's one God, how can it be that, you know, God, the God of the Old Testament, is the father of God.
That's right.
Son,
yeah. They were convinced that this miraculous event had happened to the world, the coming of the divine Son of God.
Right.
And they had the literary remains of the people who had met him.
Yeah.
Okay. And the accounts of what they did and all the rest of it. And right. they said, okay, these documents are cool and they're full of awesome stuff, but they're also full of a lot of real puzzlers or a lot right. of head scratchers, you know?
Right. Right.
And one of them is the fact that, you know, there's only one God, and that's affirmed very, very strongly.
Right.
And yet Jesus and his father both seem to have the complete full attributes of Godhood.
Right.
And yet they talk to each other.
Yes.
They communicate. It's not just some sort of apparition. They communicate with each other. They have a relationship.
Right.
Which is the really puzzling thing.
Yes. And Jesus says, God, the Father is greater than I am, and I and the Father are one.
That's right. Yes. Which certainly seems to affirm that in some sense, he and the Father are two, because.
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, right. So the early, and then, you know, and then there's, like, the Holy Spirit figures in somewhere, and the Lord is the Spirit, says Paul.
Right.
And so, yeah, so the early church spends a huge amount of time just, and plus it's got what you might call sociological problems that it's trying to figure out, like, okay, the whole thing was started by Jews who all, you know, engaged in temple worship and kept kosher and, you know, did all of this. But Gentiles don't have to do any of that stuff, according
That's right.
to those Jewish guys, right?
Right, exactly.
And it's and like, was the, what, you know?
The very name, Jesus Christ, I mean, he's got the title Jewish Messiah in his name.
Right, the job description.
That's right. So you can't cut him off from Judaism.
Right.
And yet the Jews, at least a portion of them, rejected him.
Right.
And he seems to contradict. Well, at times he just comes right out and contradicts Moses.
Right.
You have heard it said, quoting Moses.
Right.
But nevertheless, I tell you. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
No Jew does this. No Jew would do this.
Yeah.
So it's a puzzler. And so all of this to say that for Marcion to posit two gods is strange, but maybe not as strange then as it is now.
Right.
Because again, the very concept of father and son implies two communicating right. beings. And yet it's not right to call them two beings. So
but at the same time, what's also notable about Marcion is the instant reaction of the church. I mean, within his own lifetime, you know, unlike, for example, with Origen, within his own lifetime and instantly, like his father, says,
yes,
get out, right?
Well, the interesting thing is, by the time he's actually rejected, this is a really interesting story. When Marcion has had the Judaizing beat out of him by the Bar Kokhba revolt, which happened in the 130s, by a whole series of terrible events that convince him that the Jewish God just sort of drives his people into hopeless attempts to rebel in order to destroy him. Mm-hmm. When he, you know, he's gone through an awful lot and has been sort of driven into his system by circumstance. I think he's got a friend who becomes a victim of the revolt. But anyway, that's for the book. But, but when he comes to the church at Rome after the revolt is over, he comes as, for one thing, a millionaire.
Really? I didn't know that.
He may have been the first Christian millionaire.
Okay.
He comes to the church at Rome after the revolt is finished as the head of a kind of a following. You know, kind of the latest thing.
Okay.
And he shows up at Rome sede vacante after the death of Hyginus, the Pope, ninth successor, I think, of Peter.
Okay.
He shows up with an enormous gift of money, hoping to be made the Pope of Rome.
Really?
Yeah, yes.
I did not know that.
Yes. And it's a fascinating story.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he got rich in the shipping business. His father apparently owned a business as well as being the bishop.
Okay.
And Marcion sort of hit the lottery when he was turned out of the church. He seems to have taken up a job as a shipping magnate, so to speak. Well, he became a magnate as time went on. He became just a sailor to begin with.
Cornelius Vanderbilt of early Christendom.
Absolutely, and okay. It's a great story. Trajan immediately starts a war at this point against Dacia and Mesopotamia, which are two-front war.
You're going to need a navy
simultaneous. Well, that just happens that those two places are on opposite ends of the Black Sea, and right smack dab in the middle is Sinope, where Marcion runs his shipping business.
Okay. Yeah,
He also seems to have become the beneficiary of a big piece of corporate welfare, because the emperor gave a complete tax write-off to any shipper whose vessels were carrying war material.
Okay.
So there's not much mystery how it is that Marcion turned up a few years later with 200,000 sesterces to devote or to donate, quote unquote, to the Church of Rome.
Interesting.
And he was willing at that time to sign an Orthodox confession.
Okay.
Which is one of the reasons to think that he hasn't been Marcionizing all along.
Okay.
But at any rate, his heresy.
But there's a stink about him, though.
Well, only because you hate millionaires, Mark. Noted leftist.
Well, but the whole early church does, too. I mean, there's a real distrust of that kind of thing, too. In the early church, you bet there is.
Yeah. Yes. 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 Well, that may be a subject for another podcast.
Okay. But that's interesting. I see why the, I could see why when you get to later on, when you get to the real hard asses like Tertullian, you know, the North African church had a bumper crap of just you know,
rigorous, I think is the word.
Hard-nosed rigorous,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no.
And they really detest Marcion. But anyway, this is fascinating. I did not know this. So he goes to Rome, he's got a bazillion dollars.
Hopefully it makes for an entertaining book. He shows up. He's willing to sign an Orthodox confession. He makes a big contribution, and you can't help but think that the contribution is conditional. But they, the church and the elders, keep in mind, there's no sitting pope.
Right.
The elders decide to accept him on the basis of the confession he signed.
Okay.
But they, but even though he's a bishop, they don't make him Bishop of Rome.
Right.
Whereupon they refund his money.
Oh, so definitely a condition then.
Yeah, it certainly seems so.
Yeah.
And but the interesting thing is, he lives, works, worships, thinks for another 6 years after this as a member of the Roman Church.
Okay.
And it may be, there's a complex discussion that I go into in the book that we don't have time for here. Maybe that Justin followed him to Rome to counteract his influence.
Okay.
Seems there's pretty good evidence, I believe, that Marcion gathered his movement, became trendy in Ephesus, which was Justin's, the place where Justin became a Christian and was living up until about this time.
Okay.
But anyway, be that as it may, the two of them definitely were members of the Church of Rome at the same time, the 140s.
Okay.
So it's hard to believe that the two of them didn't rub elbows, if not lock horns, during that period.
Okay.
And it's interesting, too, that Justin becomes the author around this same time of a book called Against Marcion. Pretty straightforward title.
That's
where, okay. Yeah, which Justin is already by this point sort of the church's go-to guy on law issues.
Right.
And due to the dialogue with Trypho.
Okay.
And this book of his, Against Marcion, becomes sort of the template that both Tertullian and Irenaeus follow in writing their own books against Marcion.
You know what's also interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Justin was a layman.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So this is a layman writing against a bishop.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I kind of compare Justin at one point to C.S. Lewis. He seems to be a popularizer or a layman whose main expertise was in making the intricacies of the faith understandable to ordinary people.
Right.
And not only was a layman, he remained a layman his entire life.
Yeah, yeah.
And ran a famous Bible study out of a private home,
mm-hmm.
With apparently, you know, perfectly orthodox, but with apparently a minimum of ecclesiastical oversight.
Well, he was something that the first and second centuries provided a bumper crop of. He was a lay philosopher. You know, that was
right.
What he was. He was just somebody who was passionate about the truth. And when he realized that Christ was the truth, said, "Okay, baptize me. I'm ready." You know.
Well, we
and,
might.
Yeah.
We might compare him to our own friend and patron of this particular book, Dr. Scott Hahn, also
yeah,
a layman, a layman, and yet. A go-to guy on theological subjects
exactly.
for many ecclesiastics
exactly
in the church
right.
these days.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is something, this is also as an aside, I suppose, but this is something the 20th century popes started saying, you know, the laity are supposed to have a bigger role than they have now.
Right, right.
Clericalism is a problem.
Right.
Not just that the clerics are trying to run everything themselves, by themselves. The lay people have got used to it, and they like it.
Right. Well, and Marcion's career demonstrates the problem of, you know, of sort of the, you know, Jose Cuervo of clericalism, you know, that this guy is the son of a bishop. He's a guy who... decides that he's smarter than the church, you know, and relies, I think, The fact that his first instinct in going to Rome is to try to buy the papacy.
He feels the need to share his insights, and where better to do it than the bully pulpit at Rome.
Sure, so. Sure. You know, but I love that Justin Martyr is his bête noire.
Isn't that great?
That's great.
You got the rogue cleric is counteracted by the faithful and what's the word? Not a popular word these days. Docile.
Yes.
Theologically docile layman.
Yeah. And that's it, you know, is that Justin Martyr is theologically docile. He is docile to the tradition. He is not docile to the fact that Marcion is rich. He's not docile to the fact that Marcion is powerful. And he's not docile to the fact that Marcion is a bishop.
And a threat to the church.
Yeah, you know, yes. What he's looking at is the tradition. And he is paying attention to the magisterium. He's not the Lone Ranger. This is somebody, and this is, I think, one of the mistakes that we see today. There was a great headline in the Eye of the Tiber, this online, it's this Catholic satire
spoof site. Yeah.
And there was a headline a few months back that says, Jesus assumes new role as Savior Emeritus as Catholic blogger takes over the task of defending the church from the Pope. And there are that's exactly not what Justin Martyr did. Martyr did not see himself as the savior of the church, and he didn't see himself as the savior of the church from the magisterium.
Right. His whole appeal is to continuity.
Yes, absolutely.
I go into this in some detail in the book, but his main motivation is to pass on what he's received without changing it.
Right. Right.
And that's always the instinct of the early church. But the clericalism thing is really interesting. The really deadly danger of clericalism is that the laity becomes accustomed to it and likes it.
Right.
In other words, the church can fall into this idea that when the collection plate comes around during Mass, we're putting money in it so that the priests and the religious can do Christianity for us.
Right.
We come here once a week and support them while they do all those things that are in the Bible.
Right.
And that's a lot easier than being a Christian.
Right. Just fill your sacramental punch card every Sunday and
support the churches, the people who are actually doing all that stuff, you know, praying the divine office and all that other stuff. You know, we're all in favor of that.
Yeah.
That's why we put money in the plate.
Yeah.
And but at any rate, Justin, yes, is a pretty good patron for the laity.
Yeah.
An informed, active, vigorous laity.
Yeah. So he writes against Marcion, and then what happens?
In the year 144, Marcion comes to the church, having been stoked up by various things. I mean, his problems were getting worse, not better. Especially since, they didn't accept him as Pope. So he stayed salty about that for the rest of his time at the Roman church, but he did stay.
Okay.
And, he seems to have encountered another guy, a fellow Roman parishioner at the same time, a guy named Cerdo, whom you may have heard his name before.
That's a new one.
Cerdo is usually called a Gnostic, but he was the guy who seems to have turned Marcion on to the idea that Paul brought an unknown God, and unknown to everybody.
Okay.
And he's the guy that may have been his major contribution to the more famous Marcion system.
Okay.
But
beware
at
of
any rate,
smart rich guys with a personal theory.
Yes. Yeah, a hobby horse to ride. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And so, yes, he seems to have spent that 6-year period between the beginning of his heresies and the actual time when he's thrown out of the church at Rome. He seems to have been in trouble the whole time.
Marcion or Cerda?
Marcion. In and out of the church in various ways, on the outs. Cerda's a kind of a pathetic character.
Okay.
He's called a heretic and all the rest of it. And he too seems to have been excommunicated from the church at Rome more than once.
Okay.
But he's unlike Marcion at this point. Marcion, you know, is got this hunger to share his wisdom with the church.
Right.
And Cerda is a,
I feel like I know Marcion. I mean, you know, he's like that. He's the guy at the party that with the loud voice that's just got a big theory, you know?
Right. And he's like the Ancient Mariner. He's going to stop one in three and hold him with his glittering eye.
Yeah.
And Cerda, on the other hand, was a very reluctant heretic. I think it's Irenaeus that says Cerda never really intended to found a sect apart from the church. And right. As a matter of fact, he always had terrible remorse after the elders turned him out of the church.
Yeah.
So that he was always coming back with tears and the elders sent him in to make a public confession. And, he got excommunicated and reconciled about 5 times during this period. Uh-huh. So he's a different personality than Marcion, but, nevertheless, Marcion seems to have picked up, at least one important idea from him.
Yeah. Hold on. Sherry, okay. I'm doing a podcast right now. Can I call you back? Okay. Thanks. Sorry.
So
about
at
that.
Any rate,
raw audio from real life podcasting.
Audio verite.
That's right.
Eventually it all comes to a head in July 144.
Okay.
I love it when we get really specific dates for things that happened 1800 and something years ago. But in July of 144, Marcion finally decided to have it out with the leadership.
Okay.
He calls them to a big meeting and demands that they explain a couple of different Bible passages. One is the passage about new wine. Jesus saying that the new wine's going to burst the old wineskins. You can't keep trying to push his new revelation into the old framework. This is Jesus declaring his independence from the Old Testament.
Right. Okay.
And then in another spot, he quotes, I've forgotten the exact, I think it's Isaiah, where he, Isaiah, gets a little carried away and says, and has God saying, am I not the one that established evil? You know, am I not responsible for all of the, evil things as well as the good?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
So he took Marcion took that idea and sort of put it in their threw it in their teeth. Mm-hmm. And so there's this big meeting and it doesn't end well and they turn Marcion out of the church.
Okay.
And at that point, Marcion's final break with the church, at that point, he's got two great advantages. He's got a fleet of ships that are still working for him, apparently,
mm-hmm.
with all sorts of connections. So that's perfect for spreading the good news of Marcionism.
Okay.
All over the world.
Okay.
And he's also got a lot of money.
Right.
For founding churches.
Right.
And which he devotes to the cause and immediately begins to set up a kind of a mirror or shadow church to the church.
Okay.
Now, this is really interesting. This is one of the most interesting things about Marcion is that unlike many heretics, well, the heretic he's most similar to here is Henry VIII. Henry VIII wanted one particular, there was one thing that stuck in his craw about the Catholic faith, and that was all this business about the Pope at Rome.
Right.
But other than that, he wanted no changes at all.
Right.
Henry hated Protestantism. He persecuted Lutherans. I mean, he hated Luther. He hated Calvin. He hated the whole thing. It was a stench in his nostrils, he said.
Right.
Henry really wanted to be Pope himself, and that was the only change he wanted.
I want is to be
Pope. That's right. and they won't let me, so that's a break. Yeah. Well, in Marcion's case, Marcion wanted his system. I mean, he wanted his idea of two gods, but other than that, he wanted it to look as much like the Catholic Church as he could.
All I want is another god.
So he founded a new order of bishops, priests, and deacons. He made churches that looked like Catholic churches. He did everything he could to keep all the things he liked about the Catholic Church, but to change the thing he didn't like.
Okay.
And in other words, he essentially made himself Pope anyway,
right?
Even though they didn't accept him at the real Roman See.
Right.
So, and then he spends the next, 20 years until his death as the Pope of Marcionism.
Okay. And the success of that endeavor is seen by the fact that no one has ever heard of Marcion today. Very worrisome to the
second, third, fourth, and even up into the fifth and sixth centuries. Marcion was the arch heretic.
Yeah.
I mean, he was until Arius came along and cast him off his throne a little bit.
Yeah,
he was the all through the writings of that period, he's the number one.
Yeah,
and it's because he had so much success. In other words, they built a movement that did last 300 or 400 years.
Yeah,
and it was for a while it almost looked like it might be a rival.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, he just gets old and dies of natural causes. He's not martyred.
Actually, no. There's a great little coda to the story.
Oh, okay.
Tertullian tells us that at the end, right before his death, he repented.
Really?
He came back. He asked for a Catholic priest. And that he reconciled with the church.
Really?
He was on his deathbed.
I'm glad to hear that.
And he came back and he said, he pronounced those horrible words, "I was wrong." Tertullian tells us that he was given the penance of devoting his entire fortune and all of the rest of his life to making up for the harm he'd done. He accepted the penance willingly, but he died before he could do anything.
Okay.
So on top of all these other crazy things about his life, he's a famous deathbed convert.
Okay. That's the most famous quote I know about Marcion comes from Tertullian. Of course, he says that Marcion had a pumpkin in place of a brain, which is just,
That's Tertullian all over.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's just a great quote.
It is true that he was a bit of a fundamentalist. He was not a deep thinker at all. His surviving writings are nothing but a lot of proof texts flung in people's faces.
Yeah, your description of his confrontation with the Roman elders tells me that. Because that's fundamentalism. It's here's the right Bible verse I've got, and it has to mean what I think it does. So
right,
that makes proof that I'm right.
Whereas Justin is a converted Greek philosopher.
Right.
And he's a converted Platonist and Pythagorean, a very sophisticated thinker. So, the two of them, if they did go into a battle of wits, Marcion went into it half-armed.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's really interesting. It's just, it's really fascinating to me. Because that kind of fundamentalist approach to Scripture just keeps coming up. You know, it's a constant in the history of the church, is you'll get somebody who is, I think, who is it? I forget. Francis, was it Francis Bacon? It says, beware the man of a single idea. And that's, you know, that's always been one of the great challenges that the church faces, is you get somebody who will get, this is probably a gross image, but I think of heresies very often as kind of mental zits. You know, you'll get this inflamed thing that just gets all swollen and crazy and feverish. And somebody will just get a single idea. And sometimes what will happen is you'll get, you know, for example, you get the, with the Judaizers, you get the obsession with the primacy of the ceremonial law of Moses. That's it. That's the big thing. Everybody has to keep the ceremonial law of Moses. And it sounds like that's where Marcion started out, but sometimes you'll get this bizarre whipsaw reaction.
Right.
Where something that you were obsessed with, suddenly you hate it.
Yes.
With all of your heart, you know, and
well,
you...
I mean, this is what Peter said when he declared at the Jerusalem Council that that the law was had been fulfilled. He said this was a yoke which neither we nor our fathers have been able to keep.
Right.
So that this and there is the argument, I think, true, that one of the purposes of the law was to, on God's part, was to bring people to the end of their rope.
Right.
It's St. Augustine who said the law was given so that grace would be sought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you get, you know, what the miracle and the grace that comes entirely from the guidance of the Holy Spirit that the church has always held, you know, is Chesterton's ability to, you know, when he talks about the church reeling but erect,
right?
That there's this, well,
the tightrope walk.
Yeah, there's this long, long tightrope walk that the church has done, in which it has found the way between these crazy extremes. That heretics are unable to negotiate. The church can find its way between Scylla and Charybdis, and heretics can't do that.
The Catholic Church has got a superpower that the other churches, like Marcion's, don't have.
Right, and it's not
the ability to stay on the tightrope.
Yeah, and God knoweth it is not because Catholics are so smart. It really is due to the grace of the Holy Spirit guiding the
church.
One of the things that a priest friend of mine remarked to me one time that I've never forgotten, and I thought it was a very profound insight. He said, one of the things that is a constant in the history of the church is that when the church holds a council, it has these brilliant insights. And then after the council adjourns, the bishops go home, and it's like they all have amnesia, and they and it takes the church 100 years to implement the stuff that the council worked out because the bishops are all such doofuses, and they.
Well, I think one of the things too.
His point was this. He said the thing that it's important to remember is that councils are, in the faith of the church, they are guided by the Holy Spirit. And so the bishops in council and in union with the Pope speak beyond themselves by a supernatural grace. Mm-hmm. And when the council adjourns, now it's just them again. And right. So he said, we can really say that in a certain sense, the bishops in council don't know what they're talking about.
Right. Because I was going to add that what normally happens is that two parties are called to resolve. I mean, that's usually when you call a council, is when there's a division, which usually breaks out into two parties. What normally happens is they reach an agreement during the council, and then after the council is over, both sets of leaders go home and declare victory to their people.
God, well, six of one, half dozen of the other, you know.
Well, that's
but
right.
that's really, I found that a really profound insight. That, yeah, it's true that councils speak beyond themselves. And you'll see this in the life of Peter. So Peter has this profound insight. We are saved by grace, not by works of the law. You know, that, you know, the law was a yoke that neither, you know, they nor right. we can bear. And then, once the council is adjourned, he goes to Antioch, and there's
some
the
prominent
Judaizing,
Jewish.
Yeah, the yeah. Judaizing faction is there, and he's going, well, okay, I guess you're right, and I'm not going to eat with Gentiles anymore.
Well, now it is important to point out that he never actually said that.
Okay.
He didn't say you guys are right. What he did was he dissimulated.
Right, exactly.
In other words, he was sat down and ate with them.
Yeah.
And Paul specifically says that he did it out of fear.
Yeah.
Now, Peter's about the least fearful person in the book of Acts. I mean, he's constantly doing crazy, reckless things for God. So, but the fear was almost certainly a fear for what these people were willing to do to the church out in the way of mutiny and schism.
Sure.
So what he did was he made a human ploy to pour oil on the troubled waters.
Sure.
That Paul comes out later and says that he did not act. He did not act in sincerity.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
what Paul says, and that I think is the bottom line.
Yeah.
A moral failure, but not a doctrinal failure.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the point. Is that Peter in council. At the Council of Jerusalem, speaking out of his office, speaks beyond himself. At the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And then once the council's over, you know, the bishops go back to their things, and then they have to work this out. And we've seen this over and again. We're about 50 years into Vatican II, and the church is still figuring out what it said at Vatican II.
Well, it's the perfect example of going home and declaring victory.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one side says everything changed.
Yeah.
The other side says nothing changed.
Yeah.
And they still say that to some degree.
Yeah. And then of course, you know what the church does is it works out this development of doctrine and says, well, nothing has changed, and yet a lot of things have changed.
That's right.
You know, our,
the reality is some things changed.
Sure. Our relationship with other Christians has obviously changed. Our right. relationship with the Jewish people has profoundly changed, thanks be to God. You know, and lots of other things are going on. Some of them are dumb, and some of them are profound and great. You know, and,
right.
and we've seen the last three popes. Really, you know, unspooling that. And, you know,
I must admit, it does come as a comfort to me in this context to realize that Marcion repented in the end.
Yes, it does. Yeah, that's
because
really good.
It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Most heretics, in fact, most grand heretics especially, have just the end that you expected to the
right.
story.
I was the rightest person of all time.
That's right. But it's a true miracle when God gives the grace for
yeah.
somebody to say, forgive me for a fool.
Yeah. Well, thanks be to God for that.
Absolutely.
Rod Bennett, I want to thank you so much. This was such fun. I love having you on the show because you're just a massive cool information like this. So
I've just been immersed in this for the last couple of years. So
well, this is really good. I'm looking forward to your book now. You've been listening to the Connecting the Dots broadcast. Our producer is Danny Head. My guest today has been Mr. Rod Bennett, and we will be back next week at some point, probably. I'm heading off next week. I'm going to be going down to Colorado Springs for the American Chesterton Conference.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
So that'll be a jolly time. But anyway, until we meet again, thanks for listening. and have a good week. Bye-bye.
So long, everybody.